Well, I think what makes Barry unique as a director is that he is by nature a populist, but he's a very smart guy behind that. I think he wants to make you laugh. I think he wants to reach you through humor. I once did a play called Death of a Salesman that Arthur Miller wrote, and Arthur Miller said, the more you make the audience laugh at this character, the more you're going to reach them at the end. And I don't think anyone I've ever met is a brighter person than Arthur Miller. And I think Barry is on his level in terms of a kind of theatrical and at the same time profound level of awareness of what makes us tick as human beings.
Can you tell us what you've found out about the enemy since you've been here?
We found out that we can't find them. They're out there, and we're having a major difficulty in finding the enemy.
Well, what do you use to look for them?
Well, we ask people, are you the enemy? And whoever says yes, we shoot them.
Difficult to find a Vietnamese man named Charlie. They're all named like Yan or Dao or things like that. It's very difficult.
Academy Award-winning director-screenwriter Barry Levinson has crafted an enviable reputation in the film industry as a director who blends literate and intelligent visions into such films as Diner, Good Morning Vietnam, Rain Man, Avalon, Disclosure, Wag the Dog, and Sphere. Born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland, Levinson would eventually attend American University in Washington, D.C., before heading west to begin his career as a writer.
My biggest ambition in life was not to work in my father's appliance store. That is the thing that stands out the most, rather than what do I really want to do. Ultimately, after American University, I didn't say after, during American University, I was taking some courses in broadcast journalism, and so I worked in Washington, D.C. for 4 years and attended classes and got a chance to direct, you know, some news programs, etc. That was like the beginning of sort of finding something that I had a passion about.
Upon his arrival in Los Angeles, Levinson worked for the Oxford Company, studying acting, improvisation, and production, and worked comedy clubs before landing a job as a writer-performer on the Loman and Barkley Show, a weekly 90-minute local program. After working on the Marty Feldman Show in England, he returned to Los Angeles to work on the Carol Burnett Show and the Tim Conway Show, which eventually brought him in contact with actor, writer, director, and producer Mel Brooks.
When I did Tim Conway, one of the producers' name is Ron Clark, and he took a liking to myself and Rudy DeLuca, who was my writing partner at that time. And we had kept in touch over those few years. I was doing Carol Burnett Show, and he called up and he said, look, I got a great idea for a film for Mel Brooks, and I'm going to have lunch with him, and if he likes the idea, I think you guys would be perfect to work on the film. And the irony is he called back after lunch and says, Mel loves the idea. He loves the idea. He wants to meet you guys, you know, and see if you guys are right to work on the film. And we met him the next day for lunch. And that quickly, suddenly we were going to, you know, write our first movie. For 3 years, we wrote with Mel. When he was shooting it, we were there during the editing process, during the scoring process. All of the stages had an opportunity to see how films go from beginning to end. And we did that on Silent Movie, and we did that on High Anxiety. So although I never really thought about being a director, from watching that on a daily basis, you suddenly would go, gee, I wonder what happens if you did this? And what happens if the camera was doing that instead of this? If I would write something, I thought that's the way everyone sees it. And you realize, no, everybody can see it a completely different way. And then I began to suddenly get really interested in the idea of directing a movie, just to see what it would be like if it goes directly from the images in your head and somehow through that process ends up on the screen looking like the way you originally thought about it.
When you want to make out, who do you make out to? Sinatra or Mathis?
That's a stupid question.
One question, answer that.
It's irrelevant, I won't answer. Mathis.
Usually. I'm married. We don't make out.
Levinson's first feature film was the 1982 release of Diner, which he both wrote and directed and shot in his hometown of Baltimore. He assembled a young cast that included Kevin Bacon, Mickey Rourke, Daniel Stern, Steve Guttenberg, Timothy Daly, Ellen Barkin, and Paul Reiser.
For a long time, I had the idea in my head, and actually Mel Brooks used to say, you know, you should really write about that, you know, that which you know well, and he would, you know, say that you should really kind of see where that'll take you. But I never could make sense out of it until one day I realized it was in terms of, you know, the guys who hung out with one another and then their real lack of understanding of the females. And when I began to understand that, it would not just be some nostalgic, you know, trip, but to understand how, you know, men and women don't quite connect and all the misunderstandings and all of those things that go with it and the fears of females at that age in a way, even though it's not expressed, it's suddenly you're entering into another tribe in a way. And so at least when that began to make sense, then I can sit down and write. And then I normally write rather quickly because I sort of build up this adrenaline and all of a sudden all of these ideas are kind of coming fast, and I just try to write and keep up with all these characters who start talking to one another.
You bring your car?
No, I walked. Yeah, I brought my car.
Are you going straight home, or what are you...
No, I'm going by way of Atlantic City. What kind of question is that?
Because if... You know, I'll wait for the other guys.
You constantly do this. You constantly walk out behind me. You stand there.
Maybe you've got plans or something.
No, I have no plans. It's 4 a.m. I have no plans. Do you want a ride?
I'll go with you if you want.
You know,
I can go with you.
Say the words. I want a ride.
I don't have to go home. If you want me to go, I'll go.
I enjoy your company. Will you want a ride?
I'll go with you. Sure.
Okay. You got gas money? Just kidding.
You know, casting is extremely important because if you cast incorrectly, what you're trying to do is cover a mistake. You know, doesn't mean the actor's bad, but their quality isn't quite working for you. So you're spending time trying to fix it. If you cast right, it can go from here to here. It can suddenly, you know, jump, and suddenly there's a dynamic that's really impacting on a film. So I saw about 600 guys or so personally for our main group, and one woman for the role of Beth, who was Ellen Barkin, because she came in, and as soon as she came in and started to go through the piece, I thought that she would be perfect. And on the other side, you can take someone like, you know, Paul Reiser, who wasn't even there for an audition. He had just, I think he was with a friend.
I actually stumbled into the part of Diner, wandered into this office where they were casting with a friend of mine who was dropping off his picture and resume, and they asked me to stay and meet Barry. And the next day we came back, and he said, sit and talk. And I had just started my very first acting class, and I was so desperate to really show him how I could act. And I said, you know, if we just do it casually, it just sounds like guys sitting around drinking coffee. And he said, yeah, but that's what I want. I want people who just sound like they're drinking coffee and they're not acting. The scene in the diner with the roast beef sandwich was literally pulled out of an improvisation that he encouraged. And he just said, just keep on going. And we just started doing this thing about eating the sandwich. And he knew enough just to steer it this way and just, you know, do a little bit more of that thing with the thing.
Where's that roast beef?
Don't ask me this anymore, Maldad. Yes.
You gonna finish that?
Yeah, I'm gonna finish it. I paid for it. I'm not gonna give it to you.
No. If you're not gonna finish it, I would eat it, but if you're gonna eat it, Joe.
What do you want? Say the words.
No, go ahead. You're gonna eat it. You eat it. That's all right.
Say the words. I want the roast beef sandwich. Say the words, and I'll give you a piece.
Would you guys cut this out? I mean, every time.
Well, if he doesn't talk, he just goes.
Well, you know what he means, right?
Yeah, I know what he means, but he beats around the bush. He beats around the bush. If he'd say the words, I'd give him peace.
If I wanted it, wouldn't I ask you?
Then ask.
He used to tell the story about how when the studio first saw this movie, they would point to that scene and say, well, we don't understand why they're doing that. Why doesn't he just give them the sandwich and get on with the story? And he would have to explain to them, that is the story. There is no story. It's just behavioral stuff. But he has such a funny and quirky way of looking and finding these rhythms and things, and that's why someday he'll be very successful.
Levinson's second film, The Natural, starring Robert Redford, was released in 1984. Levinson had met Redford at a Sundance gathering, which led to the two men getting together again some 8 months later to talk about Levinson directing the film. It was a project he said he felt comfortable doing from the very beginning.
For whatever reason, I mean, I felt confident about that. And there's something about sort of being a little dangerous, especially when we don't do a baseball movie in a conventional way. So, I mean, it's much larger than life, and it's almost mythological, so that it has all these kind of elaborate, you know, displays of things that happen throughout the film. It was challenging in that way, but I wanted to see if we can get to that kind of mythology. And I have to say that, I mean, Redford, you know, took a huge chance. You know, took a chance on a guy who made this, you know, a little movie, and here's a guy who's already been a terrific actor for a number of years and won an Academy Award as a director. So for him, as a major movie star, to take that gamble was, I can only thank him many times over.
This silver bullet head has been in your stomach for some time. Years, I would say.
It doesn't matter, it's history.
Yes, but it could prove fatal if you continue to play baseball. Stop now, and in time, you could heal properly.
Can I play Monday?
The odds and your rage would be against you. One day your stomach could easily just blow apart, kill you on the spot. I'm sorry.
Come on, we haven't got all day.
Well, hang on, where are we going?
You wouldn't want to miss chemistry class, would you?
By the way, what's your name?
Holmes. Sherlock Holmes.
In 1985, Levinson released Young Sherlock Holmes from a script by Chris Columbus and was based on the premise that Holmes and Watson did not meet as adults, but in a boarding school. The film featured some groundbreaking special effects.
I was attracted to Young Sherlock because I love the Victorian period, and I thought, I'd love to kind of play in there and create that kind of world of Victorian England. And I wanted to learn about special effects too. You know, not that I'm going to rely on them or they're going to be, you know, part of what I do all the time. But I do think you have to understand all that. You have to understand all the new tools that keep coming to film. Generally, with special effects things, they need to be in the script and discussed and elaborated on, and then all of that input that can take things to another, you know, stage, or how to accomplish something that no one's sure how to pull that off. In the church, where we have the sequence with the stained glass man who comes out, jumps out, stained glass thing comes down, and it's a real person, and the vicar is backing up, he's having a hallucination. And I had said, what happens if we kind of come around, you know, it's like, you know, we see him coming towards us and the camera keeps moving around until we're over the shoulder of the stained glass man looking back at the vicar. So we're just making this complete, you know, move. And they said, well, it's interesting, you know, we've not done that kind of a thing. And I said, well, why don't we just shoot it and see if it's possible that we can make that work. But that was the first time of being able to make those kinds of, you know, moves. Of course, now, you know, it's taken for granted as the technology keeps advancing.
Are you a lunatic? Are you telling me that you didn't see me coming out of this lot? Huh? There's a red light there, for crying out loud. You're supposed to stop.
Me?
Are you crazy? What do you want to just back into the middle of the street like that? A man's driving along and you want to back into the middle of the street. What kind of driving is that?
Tin Man, starring Danny DeVito and Richard Dreyfuss, was from an original screenplay written by Levinson and based on characters he remembered from his hometown of Baltimore, where the movie was filmed.
When I was doing Diner and, you know, they're setting background, and I looked over, you know, at the people in the diner, and I said to the assistant director, I said, we need some of the older guys sitting over here to the left side. We need older guys over here. He said, why? I said, well, that's where the tin men would sit. He said, well, who are they? And I explained that they were the aluminum siding salesmen, and they used to hang out there, and we used to hear their stories, and they were like the Damon Runyon, you know, characters, you know, that he would write about. It was Baltimore's version. So I always used to tell the stories about the Tin Man and everything else, and then one day it occurred to me that it'd be interesting to do a piece that really is about, like, in the 60s, which would be like the beginning of, like, the death of, like, you know, the rat pack sensibility and the rise of, you know, feminism. And so there'd be kind of an interesting, you know, way to play that out in a storytelling manner. And so I sat down and Tin Man came about.
Well, can't my house be the after picture in Life magazine? You could get another house for the before.
What do you mean? Oh, you mean the... Oh, you would like your house to be the after picture with aluminum siding. And then we would have to find another house to look like their house with for the before picture.
Is that possible, Hans?
Oh, I don't know if we can manage this. What do you say?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of pushing it, baby. It's pushing it. Well, look, what time's your husband get home? Because he'd have to go over the figures with the salesman. That's if there's even a salesman available this evening.
Jerry will be home at 7.
That'll be a total of $3,700.
$3,700?
Honey, we're going to be in Life magazine.
Good morning, Vietnam!
Good morning, Vietnam, based on the real-life exploits of Army disc jockey Adrian Cronauer, was released in 1987. It was the first film about the Vietnam War that took a totally different approach, showing the lives of military men as they interacted with the Vietnamese population. It was, to say the least, a tour de force for actor-comedian Robin Williams.
I met Barry Levinson. It was an open dance call.
I met Barry, and he forced me to fly to the Philippines, and he had a pat of butter, and I said, what type of improv is this?
I had to sing Oklahoma in Thai and Vietnamese. Oklahoma Nam Kim Ha Lokamehede. Here's the main thing that Barry wanted to do, is to show kind of another side of the Vietnam War that I think that other people hadn't seen, the kind of all the, just like the backstory, literally, of all, you know, the guys who working kind of in the, you know, the back support, all the other things, and also in Saigon, the memories of being on leave, and also to treat the Vietnamese people as not either someone you shoot at, but actually people who are there in the midst of a war trying to, you know, deal with us.
We had seen the few Vietnamese movies were made, but they're always like fighting, and it's in the jungle, and it's the enemy, or we're the enemy, or whatever it is. But it's that. It is the war zone. And when I read it, I thought, oh, it'd be interesting that you can show the Vietnamese as people in a place, in a town. And then this character who ultimately comes in contact with them, and we just be able to see them with their sense of humor and everything else, and their knowledge that there will be this war that'll be devastating. And I had not seen them portrayed as just people, the Vietnamese.
Well, it's also an unrequited love story, which was interesting. And that's, you know, part of the reasons we want to do this movie.
Yeah, I like you. I just want to be your friend, okay?
I can do this, Cronop. No friend, Cronop. No, for me. My brother, okay, friend. But Vietnam ladies, not friends. Okay. Not friends.
There was things written, you know, for the you know, the Vietnamese to say, but they really can't, you know, they couldn't say the lines that way. So what I would really did for a lot of that was we wouldn't slate. We would just turn the cameras on and they would start talking, or Robin would talk to them, or I might say something and just kind of get it going. And then you would really get their own personality, you know, would begin to emerge. And that's how that really came about. So the softball game, what I did is they didn't understand how to play, you know, baseball. In fact, there's an interesting moment when one of the characters is supposed to be pitching the melons, you know, that they're hitting. He said, you know, he comes over to me, he says, you know, I have seen a real, softball with my own eyes, and this is not the type that they would be using. I said, you know, I'm not in charge of the equipment. You're going to have to talk to somebody. He said, well, who do I talk to? I said, why don't you go talk to Robin about it? Maybe he can straighten it out.
This is very sweet, man. This is not a baseball. I know what a baseball is. This is not a baseball.
There are a number of moments like that where they're just trying to express themselves, and it works for the film because in the context of it all, it makes perfect sense.
Read baseball is much smaller and harder than this one.
You got me there, Wilk, because I'm sorry, we have no budget, you see, and I got to get on a plane, and we have to do with what we can. Give me your hand.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all the same.
Thank you all the same. And what, you want to take the ball?
No.
You know, Good Morning Vietnam has a number of things that I'm fascinated by. I remember we were out in the village, and he was sitting there, and there were the family members, and one of the little kids was crying or whatever, and that became the scene, because what the scene was as originally written, we really couldn't do because, you know, the Vietnamese, you know, people they had couldn't make it work that way. So that scene is really made up from, you know, Robin, who is what takes place there, and how he's trying to amuse the kid to keep the kid from from crying because he was. And that simple moment of that, I thought was really kind of fascinating, the servicemen, you know, out there in a Vietnamese village, and how they interact even though they really can't communicate.
Okay. You were nominated for an Oscar and won a Golden Globe as the best actor for your work in Good Morning Vietnam. Ho-ho! Let me let the smoke out. There. Yes, I won a Golden Globe. It's so fabulous. And nominated for an Oscar, yes. How much credit do you give Barry for that good fortune?
I give Barry all the credit. Barry, kisses, nipple tweaks.
You did it, man. Barry actually was the first person to combine comedy and drama for me and actually make a dramedy, and which was quite lovely. I thank you, Barry. I would have thanked you if I had won, but hey, guess what? Once again, it was Daniel Day-Lewis.
California.
Bruner! Court. Who is this guy?
We dismissed him.
Raymond is your brother.
Now the dispute settled here on form. People's court.
My brother? I don't have a brother.
Dismissed in court case and have the dispute settled here in our form. The people's court.
After failing to attract a director for the production of Rain Man, Dustin Hoffman turned to Levinson to assist in attracting director Sidney Pollack to the project. Along the way, Levinson realized that he in fact wanted to direct the picture himself. For his efforts, Levinson won both the Oscar and Directors Guild of America Awards as Best Director.
The first director was Marty Brest, and then Spielberg got involved, and then Sidney Pollack flirted with the idea of doing it and then turned it down. And then it was at that point that I met Barry and heard that he knew Sidney Pollack, and I said, please, would you call Sidney and tell him that you think it's a worthwhile project, because Sidney was worried about the structure, and Barry thought it was a good structure. I learned later that Barry's wife, Diana, kept nudging him, and he put his hand over the phone. He said, what? I'm talking to Sidney. And she says, Barry, I can tell the way you're talking that you should do that movie. You have to do that movie. Stop trying to convince him to do it. We had to then wait for Sidney to pass, and he did. And Barry took that on after I had been with it for about 2 years. And I was so surprised that Barry seemed to understand what it took me almost 2 years to learn about the disability.
I thought, well, you have someone who is autistic, and so therefore, and they're in a car with a guy who's a salesman and a con artist and a manipulator and a wheeler dealer, and he can't do any of those things to the person sitting next to him. There is no interaction that's taking place here. You know, Raymond can't be changed. He doesn't pay attention to most things. There's no conversation that's going on. And so to really strip away all of the other storytelling devices and adventures that may happen or anything else and just put two people into a car and let the movie really rest on their shoulders as we make this journey, I thought would be kind of interesting. In many ways, it's probably the most incredible freeing experience because we were able to kind of do and find things along the road. So things happened and take advantage of it, and it evolved, and then this was it seemed interesting, and you put that into it. And so it was very loose type of filmmaking as we went from Cincinnati to Los Angeles on this journey. You know, Dustin is terrific in that he researches it, he has wonderful ideas, and then he has this moment of, you know, I can't do it. I don't know how to do this. I'm not sure what to do.
I was in the car in that wonderful Buick convertible with Tom Cruise, and they had to put a camera in the car and a light, and they told us that, you know, we sit there, there's no director, we start driving, and you go like this in front of the camera, you turn something, but you have two-way radio, they say, turn it on, you go, you clack stick with your hands, and you start acting. And Barry says, if you run out, just go again or improvise. You know, just go through a 10-minute roll. And we did it, and we came back, and Barry was sitting in his chair laughing, and I said, what's the matter? He says, you got to see this. And he pointed to the part that happened by improvising, and he says, you see what you're doing there?
However it happened in the discussion about that came, yeah. So if you see the movie, it's what keeps him in the scene and allows him to be interested in something else. It's like he hears something, but he doesn't pay attention to it. So if he's doing like that, he says, Raymond, you want to get something to eat or whatever?
Yeah, yeah. And Barry said, why don't you just try that? Whenever you are worried during a take, just go there, quote. And it was brilliant direction, because that's what I did in there, and I was home free.
Of course, I'm an excellent driver.
You know how to drive?
Yeah.
When did you drive?
Of course, I drove the Buick on a driver when my dad came to Walbrook.
Is Dad in the car? Is Dad in the car, right?
Yeah.
Did he let you drive the Buick?
Yeah, so on a driveway.
Well, we'll have to let you drive sometime.
Raymond! Never touch the steering wheel when I'm driving. Do you hear me?
Yeah.
To be able to sit there and never always know that I could internalize it or say, yeah, yeah. It put me in the place of the, as close as I just felt in there. I don't know how else to explain it. But he gave it to me. It was as good a gift as I've ever gotten from any director.
I like having you for my big brother.
Yeah.
I came to America in 1914 by way of Philadelphia. That's where I got off the boat. And then I came to Baltimore. It was the most beautiful place you've ever seen in your life. There were lights everywhere. What lights they had. It was a celebration of lights. I thought they were for me. Sam was in America. Sam was in America.
Levinson both wrote and directed the 1990 release of Avalon, a deeply felt, personal story of an immigrant's life and times in Baltimore. It was the third of Levinson's Baltimore Chronicles, following Diner and Tin Men, and featured actors Armin Mueller-Stahl, Aidan Quinn, and Kevin Pollak. For his efforts, he won the Writers Guild Award for Best Screenplay, written directly for the screen.
It's really about the importance of family and the inevitability of leaving the nest and the nest dispersing, the inevitable separation as the youngins become individuals. And I love how Barry used television and the advent of the modern age through the eyes of television as from the big Thanksgiving meals become the TV trays in front of the TV.
I wasn't interested in it, although I read it about it a lot of times. It's about the immigrant experience and whatever, of which in my mind had almost nothing to do with the immigrant experience because it really begins in 1948. All it is the storyteller. It's really about the death of the storyteller, the head of the family, the one that tells you all the stories about who did this and whatever and where they came from and all of that. And then the other storyteller that came into the house, wrapped up in a nice box with a ribbon on the top, and that one took control. And that became the storyteller. And that's what I was interested in, is exploring, in a sense, the dynamics of television in the 50s and the move to suburbia and the changing of the economics of it and the impact on an extended family. So that's why I'm always confused, or not always, but sometimes you go, oh, I'll see a thing, you know, it's about the immigrant experience in America. It might as well be a movie I never heard about, you know what I mean, because it was so unlike what I thought I was ultimately doing, which really dealt with the influences of television and the changes once suburbia, you know, came about, and how that extended family, you know, broke up.
I came to America in 1914. I came to America in 1914.
My manager at the time suggested that I work with an acting coach, which I'd never done, had no formal training. So I went to Barry and said, can I get a copy of the script for this acting coach, you know? And Barry said, oh no, I'm not letting some acting teacher come here and screw this up, what you did in the audition. No, what you did, who you are, is the character I created. That's what you're going to do, right? I don't want anybody else getting in here and just relax. Be loose and natural, you'll be terrific.
Discount department stores.
Right.
This place is enormous. What's the worst thing that can happen?
It goes under.
It goes under? Right. All right, how much money you got right now? What do you got?
You got nothing.
You got nothing.
I got nothing because every time I make a dollar, you want to expand.
All right, God forbid the place goes under. You can't have less than nothing. Not allowed. What are we? We're a discount warehouse. There's never been nothing like it. We got no frills, no fixtures. We're stripped down. No one's ever done this. I have to invent new ways of counting money. We're going to tear up this town. Yeah.
He just not only trusted the actors to do what they would bring to it, but he knew if he kept doing it, eventually they'd hit the exact moments the way he wanted them to, without feeling as though they had been told what to do.
See, it's interesting. I don't know how to define what I do because I'm not sure what I do. You know what I mean? You're dealing with the moment of how you... It's not like, you know, it'd be great if there's this one book. You know, what do you do to talk to actors to get them to do what you want to do? Book. I don't know. You just have to, in a sense, be on the same kind of wavelength at a certain period in time so everybody seems to understand what it's about, the style that it's done in, rather than trying to explain. Sometimes there's a sentence or a line or an actor doesn't understand. But at some point, everybody has to get, you know, tuned in to the piece that you're going to make so everybody's comfortable with it. And my feeling is you want to create a comfort so that behavior comes out in ways that you may not expect. It's the way I think sometimes when you're having a conversation with some individual, and when they're really kind of loose, there is something about it that sparkles at times. Otherwise, it's just we're going through the motions of talking. And that's all I try to do, is find the way that you find this comfort zone where everybody thinks and seems to be on the same wavelength.
The life of mobster Benjamin Bugsy Siegel would be the subject of Levinson's 1991 release of Bugsy, starring Warren Beatty as Bugsy and Annette Bening as Virginia Hill, and featured Harvey Keitel, Ben Kingsley, Elliot Gould, and Joe Mantegna as George Raft. For his direction, Levinson received the Los Angeles Film Critics Association's Best Director Award. Bugsy was based on Dean Jennings' book, with a screenplay by James Toback that followed closely Siegel's rise and fall as one of America's most infamous mobsters.
The way you were staring at me, I thought you were going to ask me for something a little more exciting.
Like what?
Use your imagination.
I'm using it.
Let me know when you're finished.
How much is true about Bugsy? A lot, actually. A lot of it is. It's condensed in a way. But I would say overall it had the real sense of what, you know, Bugsy was about. And what I was fascinated by is how frightening that character can be. Because he's not like a thug in a way. He's an attractive man, charming as can be, and he was out in Los Angeles and he was around Hollywood types. So he would hang out. He went to those parties, and this was a guy who was like a killer. This is a guy who's like a psychopath. And that to me is what makes Bugsy so frightening. Because, you know, if you got a gangster, guy's a gangster, he's a gangster. But for him to be that charming, that's an interesting character to explore.
I think one of the things on the picture on that particular movie on Bugsy that made it so special was the relationship between Warren and Barry, because Warren produced it as well as acted in it. He and Warren together were a great combination, and Warren would, you know, might say on a given day, we had thought the story was going in this direction, but you know, I really think that this is what we need in this section. And Barry might say, well, I don't know what you mean by that, and they would discuss it. And it was always very good. It was the kind of creative discussion you want to have happen on a movie set. And Warren would think of something, or he would think of something, and together they worked very well all the way through the post production and everything. There was a great mutual respect between them that I think made the movie what it is, which is a really classy movie.
You always protected me, Benny, when we were kids. You were always behind me. But I can't protect you.
Why, she is.
What about them?
I own a third of the hotel. I'll sell it.
That's all you've got, Ben. You'll end up with nothing. After all this, nothing.
But the Flamingo will be there. That's not nothing.
The most difficult part of shooting Bugsy, probably in the fact that we had to, recreate that casino that doesn't exist in a place, you know, that is so radically different. So we had to just find a desert and put our hotel out there and let it be the beginning of Vegas.
What's so interesting about him as a director is that obviously there's a whole lot going on in there in terms of his imagination of how he sees the picture that you can't just get from reading the script. I mean, that's true, obviously, in everything you do, but even more so, I would say, with Barry, in the sense that you can read the script and can have certain kind of almost a linear kind of a setup to it, and you kind of say, okay, well, this is the story, and this happens, and that happens, and this happens. But then when you actually see the film, there's a whole other spin that he brings to it in terms of how he was shooting it and how he's edited it and how he's added the different elements, and just in terms of his perspective. Obviously, it's the difference that, you know, every director brings to a project, and it's the thing that makes him who he is and makes him unique.
I love my job. He loves his job.
In 1992, Levinson released Toys, starring Robin Williams. It was a script he wrote with writing partner Valerie Curtin, and although it was Levinson's longtime pet project, it failed to gain support from either the critics or audiences. Jimmy Hollywood, starring Joe Pesci and Christian Slater, was released in 1994. The film was both written and directed by Levinson and was a look at life in seedy, contemporary Hollywood.
This was the mecca for dreams. This place used to sparkle. Could rub shoulders with movie stars walking along the boulevard. Glamour. Look at Hollywood now.
You wanted to see me about something.
Yeah, I was sorry about this morning. You know how it is with the kids.
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever met Meredith Johnson, Tom?
Meredith? Hi.
What's the matter, Sanders? That's a hello you give to a rash.
I'm just a little preoccupied. It's nothing to do with you.
Sanders and I go way back. He broke my heart.
He's making that up.
Disclosure, starring Michael Douglas and Demi Moore, was released in 1994. Based on Michael Crichton's book of the same name, it proved to be a huge success for Levinson. It was a scathing examination of sexual harassment in the workplace, with plenty of surprising twists and turns.
Well, I thought what Crichton did very well was to create, he wanted to deal with a sexual harassment issue. And rather than dealing with it straight head on, which sometimes I think is the easy way to say, oh, okay, you know, and you can play that out and explore it, etc., is to say, well, let's turn the whole thing upside down and now really look at it and see the, you know, the problems, the dangers, etc. Well, it's an interesting thing about when somebody says about the graphic nature of the sex scene. That scene is really the sense of which the entire movie will play out, because what took place, what happened, and that whole thing will be debated. That incident will be debated throughout the film in one way or another. So it needs to be strong enough, and in a sense that we interpret it in ways that may not have taken place. So someone can say, well, you know, the nudity, whatever, of which there wasn't, but it's our interpretation. It was done in a way that it allows the mind to work, and therefore the mind came up with things that took place in that sequence. Because then you've really done the trick of where films are the best. You don't really have to show it. You have to find a way to create it so that it's in your mind, and because that'll become stronger. There's nothing better than when you can really, you know, tap into the imagination and then therefore see things that really never happened.
Catch a wave and you're sitting on top of the world.
The temperature topped out at 98 degrees on the day our lives were forever altered.
I'm flying like an egg up here. I say we get some butter rolls, a couple of sodas, and head down to the docks. We walk the grass.
Can't you feel the breeze up here?
What breeze? We're surrounded by a wall, Gene.
The devil can even stay.
You guys shut up, please. I'm trying to get my bird.
It's 98 degrees, John.
There's some breeze up here.
It's a hot breeze.
We haven't hit the hot dog bin in a couple of weeks.
Oh, no, Mikey. That cock guy ain't like the others. I mean, he gets pretty pissed. Like crazy when you try to take him off.
We can eat hot dogs. We can eat it.
With an all-star cast that included Kevin Bacon, Robert De Niro, Dustin Hoffman, Minnie Driver, Jason Patrick, Brad Pitt, and Billy Crudup, Levinson's 1996 release of Sleepers told the disturbing tale of reform school abuses of poor boys from Hell's Kitchen. It was an absorbing tale based on Lorenzo Cacatera's book, some of which was questioned as to its authenticity.
I believe that what he really wrote about is very much, you know, the truth. You know, did he take some kind of liberties with certain things that were not so important to it? I'm sure he did. But I think the hard details of the piece are accurate. You know, the film in the final analysis tells the story from the viewpoint of this individual. This is not my story, it's his. It's told, the narration is told from the standpoint of that individual. If there's any kind of inaccuracy in it, that's the way this person saw that what happened in his life up to a particular year. That's valid enough in itself. This is not some specific indictment against a particular institution in any given place. This is the way that character, who is the narrator of the piece, sees the events that unfolded, and that's interesting and storytelling worthwhile.
You want a Rolls Royce? You don't come here. No. You go to England or wherever the fuck they make it. If you want champagne, you go see the French. If you need money, you find a Jew. But if you want dirt or scum buried under a rock somewhere or some secret nobody wants anybody to know about, there's only one place to go. Right here, Hell's Kitchen. It is the lost and found of shit. They lose it and we find it. Forget about it, man.
The moment that I thought was extraordinary, and I think it's De Niro's listening to what Jason Patrick's character tells him that happened in the reform school. And we don't really hear what Jason Patrick says specifically. You know, it almost, we can't quite hear it. And the camera stays on De Niro as he hears what happened and just sits on him for maybe 25 or 30 seconds. I think that that shot on his face is one of the most amazing moments that I've seen in film. It's like an individual hearing something that is so devastating and done with such simplicity. I think it's one of the great moments in film for me.
And you want me to do what? We want you to produce. You want me to produce your war? Not a war, it's a pageant. We need a theme, a song, some visuals. We need, you know, it's a pageant. It's like the Oscars, that's why we came to you.
Levinson could not have known the impact his 1997 release of Wag the Dog would have on an evolving Washington scandal. Once again, Levinson cast Dustin Hoffman and Robert De Niro in the leading roles, along with Anne Heche, Woody Harrelson, Dennis Leary, and Willie Nelson. The film was awarded a special jury prize at the Berlin International Film Festival. It is also interesting to note that by Hollywood standards, the movie was shot in record time.
Bob was going to do another film. I was going to do another film, and you know, with Dustin. And we said, yeah. I said, well, I think we can shoot this. We should shoot it quick and whatever, do it like a 30-day, you know, movie, like a really kind of down and dirty thing. And it's one of those things of everybody going, yeah. You know, it's like, all right, let's try and put on the show.
You know, they shot that film so fast, you know. I guess, you know, very few directors could pull this off. But he somehow shot it like in 28 or 29 days.
More than anything, it was don't ad-lib and say the lines as quickly as possible. And that's basically how it ended up playing out, because it was so beautifully written that you didn't really need to put any spin on it other than exactly what was there.
And what Barry did constantly on that film, particularly with me, which was so helpful, which was to say, take the burden off yourself. Don't try to make this line funny. Don't try to make this scene funny. Just play it for real. I mean, play it rhythmically and don't worry about it.
This is what I need. Why don't you give me 30 secretaries? You put them in an office now, okay? Would you do that? You just tell them I'm coming up. I need to see the president. I need 5 minutes of his time. Speech is corny. You know, this reminds me of years ago when I first went out to Hollywood. They said to me, it's too theatrical. He knew I was from the theater, so everything that was over the head, it's too theatrical.
Not theatrical. He thinks it's too corny.
First, don't tell me the speech is corny. Just tell him I'm coming up. I'm coming up.
I mean, things were as similar as the girl in our Barry's film had a beret, and then Monica Lewinsky was wearing a beret. I mean, the things were so close.
I think it was ironic that, you know, a short time after it came out, the title of it was being bandied about all the time in regard to what was going on with Clinton.
There was a group of Firefly girls from Santa Fe here last month. One of the girls expressed an interest in a Frederick Remington bust. The president took her into, you know, the office behind the Oval Office for a period of 3 minutes. It couldn't have been over 3 minutes. The Secret Service would bet you.
So it's not the illegal immigrant in anything. The girl's alleging... Jesus, Mary Joseph.
I talked to a couple, you know, like, you know, news people, you know, privately, and said, well, you know, this can happen or whatever it may be. And they said, it's fun, you know, but it can't happen. And then all of these things happen. You know, I mean, all of these circumstances, everything, to the fact we have Albania in the piece and that she's wearing, you know, a beret, you know, in one of our shots. I mean, so many things ended up, you know, coming out that way, and all the kind of diversionary tactics and how the press can, you know, function, and how you try to move the story over here when it's over here, and all of those things that came to be.
Spear, released in 1998, would prove to be a difficult and demanding film to make because of the confinement of the sets on which the film was shot. Dustin Hoffman returned to work with Levinson once again, along with Sharon Stone, Samuel L. Jackson, Peter Coyote, and Liev Schreiber.
Well, Spear was difficult because it's this little teeny habitat, 2,000 feet underwater. So it's claustrophobic and it's small. You know, it can't be some enormous thing, you know. And in order to make that work, it is claustrophobic.
It was made to keep us confined, to limit the camera in a way that they thought would make more interesting shots. It was tough, and it was the kind of movie that we all knew was such a dangerous film to make because you're trying to break new ground. You're trying to make a thriller that's somewhat intellectual, where there's no real monster, where the monster is your own imagination.
I know enough not to get killed down here. Are you the most qualified in your field?
What exactly are your qualifications?
Why are you here?
Your qualifications.
Why are you here?
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 Are you the most qualified in your field?
You've almost got me killed.
Your qualifications.
Killed.
Why are you here?
You're in danger of all of us.
He's in Dr. Albury.
Come back to reality.
Why are you here?
It's not an action picture. It has action in it, but it's really a psychological thing. And that's always very hard to pull off, because what is real and what is imagined? What is actually going on down there? There is no monster. You know, the sphere is not a monster. You know, it doesn't come crashing in and chasing you through the building. There is nothing there. It is just the fear that's in the mind that somehow this thing set off, that so got these people so paranoid about things that things took place. And so it was really a movie that was a mind game and a very much of a psychological piece rather than an action film.
The 1999 release of Liberty Heights would continue Levinson's funny and dramatic series of Baltimore-based films. The movie focused on the changing times of the mid-1950s and the issues of religion, race, and class distinction. The film featured an ensemble cast starring Adrian Brody, Bebe Neuwirth, and Joe Mantegna.
Well, Liberty Heights, I mean, looking at the trilogy of Baltimore, I guess I would call the Baltimore pictures that Barry made prior to it, meaning Diner and Tin Men and Avalon, this seems to be a fitting fourth installment of that group of pictures, in the sense that obviously it's something that's either fictionally or non-fictionally, or I would think a combination of both, of experiences drawn from his past and his whole thing of growing up in Baltimore in the 50s. Here was something that when you read the script, you just instantly knew this was something a little different, a little special. Because even unlike Bugsy, which I thought was, which was a marvelous script, as I had said, but now here's one that was now something Barry had written. You just felt that in terms of his input into the project, the stakes have even been raised a bit, because now this was something more personal.
What are you doing? Don't you have homework?
I was just taking a break.
Your mother call?
No, but she said this morning to expect her early evening.
Well, why don't you get back to your homework?
Okay.
What's going on?
I have a boy over. But it was nothing. We were just listening to records. That's it.
And where is he?
He's in the closet.
If nothing was going on, why is he in the closet?
Because he's white.
Somebody will say to me, when are you going to do the next Baltimore story? And I have no idea. And it's when something hits me. And it comes from different places. Oddly enough, Liberty Heights really comes from a review of Sphere, in which it talks about Dustin Hoffman as being a Jewish psychologist, and then saying, okay, he's not officially Jewish, but as soon as he arrives on a boat, you know, he's nudgy and mensch-like and wants to call his home, you know, and then says in parentheses, you do the math. And I thought, what the hell does that mean? I mean, you do the math. If I do the math, I'm going to find out that he's Jewish. You know what I mean? How come I don't have to do the math, you know, with a Mel Gibson or, you know, with Tom Cruise? I mean, they're actors. I mean, Sphere has nothing to do with Judaism. It has nothing to do with religion. It's not an issue in the film. You know, we're not going to question if Mel Gibson's in Ransom. Is he a Catholic industrialist? I mean, he's an industrialist. You know what I mean? It's not important to the piece. And I somehow, it drove me nuts. For a couple of days, I kept saying, why would they keep going on about the fact of him being Jewish in a movie that has nothing to do with that? And for whatever reason, suddenly I began to think back to, you know, when I was a kid and the fact that I thought the whole world was Jewish when I was a kid. When I was like, you know, 6 years old, I thought the whole world was Jewish. And then I went to school, and then all of a sudden, I realized, gee, not everybody's Jewish. There are people who were not Jewish, you know. And then I realized there are a lot of people that are not Jewish. And then I realized, guess what? 99% of the world is not Jewish. And that realization of that at that moment in my life, and then I began to think back to when they integrated the schools and all of a sudden you had blacks, and I thought, wow, how come it never occurred to me before that there were no blacks in the school? You know, that they weren't allowed. It didn't occur to me. You know, why wouldn't they be allowed? And then I began to think about when we began to cross Falls Road, which would have been like, you know, to us was like, you know, this Gentile area where there were like all these blonde-headed girls, you know what I mean? Like we might as well go into Norway or something. And all of a sudden we were like fascinated. And then you realize, wait a minute, you've been living in a ghetto in a way. And so then I began, all of those kind of things began to swim in my head, and then that's where, you know, Liberty Heights came about.
Where do you think you're going?
To a party. It's Halloween.
You are not leaving this house dressed as Adolf Hitler.
It's Halloween. That's the joke.
Couldn't you have gone as a pilot or a reindeer, huh? I can't.
Either take that off or I'm calling your father. You are not going out of this house, period.
Yeah. What do you mean he looks like Adolf Hitler?
Your father wants to talk to you.
Yeah.
Basically, in terms of Baltimore, it's a short period of time when you think of it in your life, and it's the most influential period. And basically, what I do is in the Baltimore films that I've done, they go back to that period of time, and as I sort of re-examine, you know, my life and the events that were occurring around it, and try to make sense out of those years, not as a piece of nostalgia, but how it ultimately relates today and where it can be, you know, relevant to today.
Let me tell you something, my little friends. Let me tell you something. Barry Levinson is fabulous. Not down, baby. Tin Man. And I was expecting to see The Wizard of Oz. Avalon. Cut the turkey. You cut the turkey without me. Once again, a fabulous thing. Jews celebrating Gentile holidays. I know after we did Toys, I was walking down the street in New York, and all of a sudden a guy came up to me and said, Robin, Toys, what happened? That's okay. That's New York. And like the thing on Rain Man where they got the cards back after the first screening where he got a card that said, I kept waiting for the little guy to snap out of it. That's what I'm telling you. Barry takes a chance. He puts people in movies that don't normally get seen in movies. That's what's beautiful. I don't know why my hand's moving like this, but right now even the deaf are going stop. I love you, Bear. I love you. I've tried to say nice things about you. Send a check.
It's very easy for a film to be made badly and for it to go wrong. From idea to execution, it's a long, long way, and he has the ability to have to stick to his vision, but at the same time be very open to other people's inputs and to absorb other flavors that he didn't come up with. He doesn't have an ego that gets in the way, and that's a pretty powerful combination to know what you're doing and also be willing to take in other people's input.
Somehow I was talking to this Japanese couple. I was walking out of a hotel. And they knew that I had done, you know, Avalon. And they talked to me and said, you know, it is just like our family. I'm thinking, Avalon is just like their family. Avalon is my family. What is so great is that I made it as specific as I could to my family, and they think it's just like their family. That's an interesting, you know, dynamic of what film ultimately can do. I've never tried to put myself in categories or think of myself any one way. Maybe that's why the movies I've done have been all over the place. My interests are kind of, you know, varied, and so I jump around, and I'm not that concerned with any specific kind of image or a type of a film. In the end, what it comes down to is that whether you write it and you're fascinated by it, whether you read it and you're dying to make it, that it is the energy and the passion to see something on the screen that is becomes the first order of business rather than anything else. When I read something and I really love it, I just want to do it, period.